Welcome to the panel, Feminism, Gender, and Sexuality in the Belle Epoque, also known as the best way to begin the conference. First up is Jean Elizabeth Peterson, who will be talking on the single standard or the double standard, public debates over proper sexual relations between men and women during the Belle Epoque. She is Associate Professor of History at the Eastman School of Music and the University of Rochester, and is author of Legislating the French Family, Feminism, Theater, and Republican Politics, 1870 to 1920, and a number of forthcoming articles, incredibly wide range. I was very impressed on Alexis de Tocqueville, Auguste Comte, women's activist social novels, and also works, I know, very important to this audience, honoring the work of Rachel Fuchs. And she's currently working on The Gender of Truth, Men and Women as Public Intellectuals in France, 1890 to 1914.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for that lovely introduction, and thank you, everybody, for coming out to the very first session of the conference. It's great to see you all. On the 24th of October, 1909, Jane Meem introduced the first installment of what would eventually become a weekly, five-month, 20-part series in the feminist journal La Française on the topic that she identified as the unity of morality, which you probably know in more colloquial English as part of the debate over whether to hold men and women to a new single standard of sexual morality or whether to endorse a more conventional double standard that privileged sexual pleasure for men and sexual restraint for women. The Napoleonic civil and criminal codes that continued to regulate men's and women's behavior inside and outside of marriage and the family under the Third Republic had instituted a series of laws that codified a sexual double standard. There were heavier penalties for adulterous women than adulterous men. There were heavier responsibilities for single mothers than single fathers. There was harsher treatment for illegitimate children than legitimate children. And even though the Naquet Law of 1884 allowed men and women to divorce each other for adultery on equal terms, it remained the case even in 1909 that the potential criminal penalties for a woman's adultery were higher than those for a man's, that a man who found his wife in flagrante delicto with another man had the legal right to take justice into his own hands by killing her on the spot, and that there was no idea at all that a woman should be able to kill her husband if she found him in a similar situation. So feminist activists and their radical Republican and socialist allies had protested these legal inequalities ever since before the foundation of the Third Republic. And they also protested the ways in which the Paris Prefecture of Police regularly responded to the social problem of prostitution by arresting, registering, and supervising the health and behavior of women who sold sex without making any parallel attempt to arrest, register, or supervise the health and behavior of men who bought sex. When Maria de Rem and Léon Richet held the first Congrès International du Droit des Femmes in 1878, the resolutions from their morals section included demands to punish men's and women's adultery on the same terms in the criminal code, to legalize paternity suits for single mothers in the civil code, to equalize the treatment of illegitimate and legitimate children before the law, and to eliminate the morals police altogether. Despite at least 20 years of solid French feminist national and international organizing, however, Jane Meem argued that a new survey on the issue was still necessary in 1909 because women were still more likely to know, understand, and have an opinion about the wildly different questions of whether or not the notorious Marguerite Steinheil had strangled her husband and her mother to death, or whether or not women should have to remove their hats at the theater, than the more fundamental question of whether or not men and women should share the same sexual rights and responsibilities. Identifying the demand for a single moral standard as the least understood of all the feminist theses, she proposed to attract her readers' interest and improve their understanding by publishing the insights of philosophers, literary figures, educators, and scientists. So I came to Meme's survey in La Française myself because I was especially interested in the state of the national and international debate over regulated prostitution. even though the French government's important extra-parliamentary commission on the morals police had just published its official report a year earlier, however, Meme's survey respondents did not take up the question of prostitution until 2 months and over 8 columns into Meme's series, and most of them never spoke about it at all. As I have continued my research into their work, then, I have become even more interested in a very different topic, which is the topic of my paper today. The vexed question of how to understand the relationships between and among feminist activists, female novelists, and those two controversial figures that historians and literary critics of the fin de siècle and the Belle Époque especially love to talk about as the new woman and the modern woman. So let me tell you something about the participants in Meme's survey, explore their ideas, and share my provisional conclusions about the significance of their contributions. Meme promised her readers that the contributors to her survey would include responses from what she called an elite as elevated as it was diverse and composed of opinions from all categories. The series opened with a substantial article by the novelist Colette Hivert, who had just published a controversial novel about women in the sciences, and it continued with 15 additional invited contributions from a range of prominent French public figures of both sexes. The 12 additional women, who constituted the majority of the contributors, included figures such as pioneering feminist doctor Blanche Edwards-Pillet, pioneering feminist lawyer Maria Véronne, pioneering feminist organizer Jean-Odo Duflux, award-winning novelist Miriam Harry, home economist Augusta Mollweiss, who directed the École des Mères and worked to improve women's labor conditions through the Ligue Sociale des Acheteurs, and the especially influential national and international feminist activist Genia Avril de Sainte-Croix, co-founder of the Conseil National des Femmes Françaises, secretary of the Fédération Abolitionniste Internationale to abolish sex trafficking in women and children, and president of the Morals Section of the International Council of Women. The three men who contributed included Catholic moralist Paul Bureau, who had just published his work on the moral crisis of the current day in 1907, radical writer Paul Marguerite, whose recent publications had included not only one of the first French New Woman novels, but also a series of literary and political works in support of divorce by mutual consent and divorce at the will of one partner alone, and medical doctor Maurice Legrain, who worked with the Assistance Publique and founded the French chapter of the Bon Templier to encourage men to give up masculine entertainment such as drinking, gambling, and, of course, sex with women outside of marriage. The series also attracted passionate positive and negative responses from 5 additional male and female readers of La Française, and it closed with a short text that reader Gabrielle Lippmann contributed from the earlier work of playwright Alexandre Dumas-Fils. So one of the most interesting things to me about the political culture of the French Third Republic is the way in which so many novelists and playwrights could participate in public debates over controversial questions on the same grounds, with a similar public stature, and in many of the same ways as activists, journalists, liberal professionals, and parliamentary politicians. Looking at Meme's survey in this light, for example, it is especially noteworthy that her 15 male and female figures included at least 6 popular novelists and playwrights, along with 2 doctors, 2 lawyers, and 2 professors. The work that Meme did in her survey is interesting not only because she included the responses of so many novelists and playwrights, however, but also because she made a special point of singling out female novelists for negative critical attention in several different ways. When she summed up the results of the survey, for example, she divided the answers into the work of the indulgents, who thought that women should forgive men's sexual misbehavior, and the intransigents, who did not. And then she identified the work of the indulgents exclusively with the work of popular female novelists, such as Colette Hivert, Madame Stanislas Meunier, Miriam Harry, and Danielle Lesueur. Meme took Hivert's support of the double standard so seriously, furthermore, that she organized her own defense of the single standard around a point-by-point rebuttal of Hivert's positions. And she took her criticism of Hivert's work even further when she focused her attention not only on the text of Hivert's response to her survey, but also on the text of Hivert's newest novel, Les Dames du Palais, the story of France's first female lawyers. The conflict between Mime and Hivert, then, illustrates both the potential continuities and the real contradictions between the work of feminist activists and the work of new woman novelists. Hivert's contribution to the survey, which Mime published under the title Feminine Virtue, Masculine Libertinage, started out by stressing that Christian moral strictures were already the same for both sexes. The real issue in Hivert's eyes, then, was not whether or not sexual misbehavior was allowable for either sex, but simply what to do in cases where men or women stepped out of line. Although Hivert acknowledged that feminists had good reasons to desire a match between female purity and male purity, she argued that there were even better reasons to uphold the traditional double standard instead. First, on a physical level, men were less capable of continence than women. Second, on a familial level, adulterous husbands were less likely to introduce bastard children into their families than adulterous wives. And finally, on a social level, men's moral influence was ultimately less significant than women's. As she put it, the supposed weakness that leads women to pardon everything to safeguard the organization of the family is one of those powers that create the order and harmony of a society. Mime's rebuttal, which she featured in the first three installments of her four-part conclusion, assembled materials from the vast majority of the other participants in the survey to make her point about the importance of the single standard instead. On the question of whether or not men were naturally less capable of chastity and fidelity than women, for example, she brought in the expert opinion of medical doctors Blanche Edwards Pillet and Maurice Legrand to argue that young men had no more need to indulge their sexual desires than young women. On the question of whether or not male adultery was less serious than female adultery, she assembled the words of seven separate male and female contributors and correspondents to support her own feminist position that infidelity was equally hurtful to the couple and the family, regardless of whether it was the work of the husband or the wife. On the question of whose sexual behavior was more harmful to society, finally, she argued that men were more likely to abandon their children than women, highlighted the importance of Maria Veyron's and Genia Avril de Sainte-Croix's contributions on the injustice of the morals police as a response to prostitution, and concluded, thus, regardless of from which side one examines this question of intersexual morality, one ends up at the word that dominates it, equality. Mime claimed that the roots of Hivert's misguided defense of the sexual double standard came from Mime's misunderstanding of feminism itself, and she based this belief on her reading of Hivert's latest novel, Les Dames du Palais, which came out while the survey was still running, a best-selling book that introduced a varied group of female lawyers, outlined the difficulties of courtship and marriage between several different pairs of female and male lawyers, and explored the emotional consequences of a series of divorce and child custody cases that pitting an unforgiving wife against an adoring husband who had committed adultery just once with a woman that he met at a cafe concert. The novelist Hivert presents Suzanne Marty as a wife who has insisted on divorcing Monsieur Alembert because Marty is a worldly and dilettantish feminist who holds to that haughty theory that places the husband and the wife in an absolute equality with regard to the moral law. Hivert's main character, Henriette Marcadieu, is a privileged young new woman who has considered painting, music, and poetry before settling on a career as a lawyer, a new spouse who insists on maintaining her new career even after her marriage to fellow lawyer Henri Vélin, a married lawyeress, as Hivert describes her, who cuts short her own honeymoon to defend Suzanne Marty's right to keep custody of her son, a loving wife and gifted lawyer who appears as what Hivert calls the incarnation of the modern woman when she triumphs and wins Marty's right to keep custody of her child. Behind both of these characters, Hivert places the figure of another lawyer, the great feminist Madame Surgère, who speaks on the importance of the single moral standard, defends Suzanne Marty's right to divorce her husband even though he committed adultery only once, rejoices in Henriette Vélin's legal victory in the subsequent custody case as a triumph for feminism, and tells their whole circle of female lawyer friends that when she campaigned for women's admission to the bar, it was a campaign directed against men, undertaken in a militant spirit, to force the equality of the sexes to be accepted, to establish justice in women's favor, but above all, to give women arms against their ancient tyrant man. Meme rejected Hivert's argument at every turn. You read her editorial, and she claims that Suzanne Marty's decision to divorce had nothing to do with feminism. She was just jealous of her husband and this other woman. She accuses Hivert of bringing her novel to a conclusion that the internal evidence of her character's arguments actually contradicts, and she violently rejects both Hivert's portrayal of feminists and her portrayal of lawyers. She asks, has she approached these women? Has she watched them live and think? It seems clear that she has not. The feminist in her book is not a woman. She has no human existence. She is a mouthpiece that opens at long intervals to preach revolt against men, pride, and the independence of women. Reasserting her defense of the single moral standard, Mim concluded her editorial, "One more time, I insist on the true sense of the feminist campaign for the single moral standard. It does not have the goal of forbidding wives from pardoning their husbands when they falter, or the goal of making society banish men who fall into the sin of love, the way society already banishes girls and women who do the same thing. On the contrary, it wants the weaknesses of both sexes to have an equal right to absolution. But it wants those weaknesses to be forbidden as equally serious for both sexes, and it wants the material consequences to be shared equally by both guilty parties." Colette Hivert's novels had a long resonance in the popular imagination. They continued to be big sellers in the 1920s, and Simone de Beauvoir wrote about them when she published her memoir of A Dutiful Daughter in 1958. She said, "My father was no feminist. He admired the wisdom of the novels of Colette Hivert, in which the woman lawyer or the woman doctor in the end sacrificed their careers in order to provide their children and husband with a happy home." Interestingly, more recent feminist literary critics have offered increasingly positive assessments of Hivert's literary output instead. Jennifer Welty Walters characterizes Hivert as a closet feminist because she presents her heroine's struggles so sympathetically. Juliette Rogers characterizes Hivert's novels about female doctors and lawyers as pioneering novels of professional development that show how women's options were opening up under the Belle Époque. And Hope Christensen presents these same novels as complex literary works that subvert both the tenets of feminism and those of anti-feminism alike. What I myself find most interesting about all these more recent readings is that they focus on completely different criteria from the ones that Jane Meem herself used to evaluate Hivert's work in Les Dames du Palais. Where these scholars spend most of their time looking at the central relationship between the lawyers Henriette Marcadieu and her husband Henri Vélin, for example, Meme was more interested in the relationship between the faithful Suzanne Marty and her faithless husband, Monsieur Alambert. Where these scholars spend most of their time focusing on the way Hivert treats the question of whether or not having a career will force a woman to humiliate her husband, and it turns out that one of the big problems for the Vélin couple is that Henriette is actually a better lawyer than Henri, which he absolutely cannot stand. Instead of looking at that couple, Meme is more interested in the question of whether or not a single double standard of sexual morality will force a woman to divorce her husband. And where current scholars have spent most of their time focusing on the character of the female lawyer, in short, Meme spent most of her time focusing on the character of the feminist lawyer. So I have gone looking through the original reviews of the book to get a better sense of the cultural context in which Meme herself was working. And here I have discovered several especially important patterns. First of all, Meme was the only one who read her book in her particular way, with a focus on the feminist lawyer instead of the female lawyer, the divorcing couple instead of the married couple, and the question of adultery instead of the question of women's work. Second, she is one of only two reviewers from the original Belle Époque period to criticize the book for not being feminist enough. Third, regardless of how feminist literary critics see the book today, reviewers at the time all agreed that it constituted an anti-feminist argument in fictional form, and that was why most of them liked it so much, and they say this over and over again. So what does this tell us about popular attitudes towards the feminists, new women, and modern women of the fin de siècle and the Belle Époque? On the one hand, it is easy to see why Karen Offen has characterized the Belle Époque as the climax of the French debates over the woman question under the Third Republic, and I recommend the fatter of the two books on the table in front of her to all of your reading attention. Meme's survey respondents included an impressive number of famous firsts. Blanche Edwards Pillet, the first woman in France to qualify for the externat in medicine. Maria Véran, the first woman to plead a legal case before the Paris Cour d'Assises. Miriam Harry, the first novelist to receive the new Prix Vie Heureuse, which you would know better today as the Prix Femina. Genia Avril de Sainte-Croix, the first woman to serve on a French extra-parliamentary commission. Women outnumbered men among the survey respondents in La Française. And all three of the men who participated also supported the feminist challenge to the double standard of sexual morality. On the other hand, it is remarkable that the vast majority of the critics who reviewed Hivert's Dame du Palais in 1909 identified it as a challenge to feminism, praised it for demonstrating a woman's willingness to sacrifice herself for her husband's happiness, and generally agreed that it was both impossible and undesirable for a woman to have a career and a family at the same time. Even Hélène Miropolsky, the pioneering female and eventually also feminist lawyer who reviewed the book for Femina less than 2 years after making headlines as one of the first women in France to plead a legal case in court, concluded her review by instructing readers this way: read the ingenious things and the fine sentiments that Madame Hivert includes when Henriette the jurist cares for her sick husband, and above all, follow the steps of renunciation of Henriette, who cherishes her husband. French feminists were right to be proud of the many professional strides they had made and the many legal reforms they had accomplished under the fin de siècle and the Belle Époque. But these interconnected debates over the single standard, the double standard, and the conflict between marriage and career indicate the extent to which legal changes would not be enough to emancipate French women without profound social and cultural changes as well. Thank you.